I'm going to talk again today for a few minutes. It's actually the third in a very dispersed series of talks about opinions and models and American pragmatism. So previously on Homeland, the first talk grew out of some stuff that our teacher John Sutherland had said at the summer retreat, evoking those moments that can happen in a retreat or at other times as well, of a kind of great freedom. And one of the things you're free from is your own judgments and opinions and habitual ways of organizing the world. You can, not only in retreat, but often in retreat, enter a kind of space where everything seems to flow really freely. You're not stuck at any one moment or any one way of looking at things. And as everything continues shifting, you somehow freely meet it, at least for a while. And those moments, paradoxically, tend also to be moments at which everything seems radiant and still and eternal. And then, of course, since we're human, we come back to Tennyville or Maryville or Robertville, and we live in the worlds of our own opinions and views and models, and there's nothing really wrong with that. One of the things we've been saying, and you all know this, that practice will tend to do over the long haul, is to give you a somewhat less locked and tied in relation to your own opinions and views. You'll have the experience very often of stepping outside them, seeing them a little from the inside, thinking it's a little strange that you also always see the world in these terms when you always might not. And I've been trying to suggest that there's a great spiritual value in that, which we'll come around to again, maybe at the end of the talk today, that it can grow out of and lead to really important shifts in our relation to the world, but that also probably it's just pragmatically or practically useful. If we have a little more freedom in relation to how we see reality, that's probably a good thing. I mentioned last time Jones saying about somebody that he had some problems because he actually believed in the contents of his own mind. And so one of the things that Zen practice may lead us to is a sense of not exactly all the time believing in the contents of our own mind and what's given to us to see by the way we process information. So I spent a lot of time last time reading from William James on the grounds that a real affinity between some of the stuff that Zen practice may lead us toward and a real sort of mainstream American philosophical and literary tradition like American pragmatism, you know, may do a couple things. It may remind us that our practice is not sort of only mystical and Eastern and esoteric and not at home in New Jersey, you know, maybe it does fine in New Jersey. And I think also it'll remind us of some of the bread and butter ways in which Zen practice can really be useful. So I had just a few more quotations from the James to read and then say one or two other things and be maybe a fairly brief talk, we'll see. And then next time I want to get on to something that kind of grows out of this but is pretty different. So I'm going to read one passage just to remind you this is where we ended up last time, and then we'll read a few things that we haven't read. So James says, this is from a book, Pragmatism, which was a series of lectures that he gave at Columbia and Harvard slightly after 1900. The absolutely true, meaning what no farther experience will ever alter, is that ideal vanishing point towards which we imagine that all our so-called temporary truths will someday converge. It, the absolute truth, runs on all fours with the perfectly wise man and with the absolutely complete experience. And if these ideals are ever realized, which they never will be, they will all be realized together, which they won't. Meanwhile, we have to live today by what truth we can get today and be ready tomorrow to call it falsehood. Ptolemaic astronomy, Euclidean space, Aristotelian logic, scholastic metaphysics were expedient for centuries, but human experience has boiled over those limits, and we now call these things only relatively true or true within those borders of experience. Absolutely they are false, for we know that those limits were casual and might have been transcended by past theorists just as they are by present thinkers. And so there he's using mostly scientific models of reality as the basis for his discussion. But I think if we practice Zen again, you know, I mean, again, I think, let me say again that I think if we practice Zen, we're maybe unusually amenable to or available to that kind of shift. We have a certain way of looking at things. Something comes at us that doesn't really seem to fit those things and that way of looking at them. And rather than sort of diving back into insistence that, you know, it's our way of seeing it and so it must be right, we're a little more likely to sort of step outside the model, be malleable about it, let some of it go, and be willing to look at things in another way. Again, it seems to me that meditation experience is very often all about that. So, on the one hand, there will stand reality. On the other, an account of it, which it proves impossible to better or to alter. If the impossibility prove permanent, which you'll never know until the world is over, the truth of the account will be absolute. Other content of truth than this I can find nowhere. Not being reality, but only our belief about reality, the model will contain human elements, but these will know the non-human element in the only sense in which there can be knowledge of anything. So he's saying there's no way out of that. We're always going to build in the human element. We're always, as a particular self, going to build in particular elements to how, or aspects of how we see things, and nevertheless, that is really the way we have of engaging reality. It would be a good idea if we didn't hold doggedly to one particular model while doing so. Does the river make its banks, or do the banks make the river? Does a man walk with his right leg or with his left leg more essentially? Just as impossible may it be to separate the real from the human factors in the growth of our cognitive experience. So you never have that moment where you say, well, I know that the way I'm seeing things is partly the world and partly me. Let me take out the me part so I can just see the world exactly the way it is. All right. To agree in the widest sense with the reality can only mean to be guided either straight up to it or into its surroundings, or to be put into such working touch with it as to handle either it or something connected with it better than if we disagreed. So the model ought to actually facilitate and smooth our transactions with the world.
Could you read that?
Yeah. He says, to agree in the widest sense with the reality. So he's saying that models don't copy reality, they're not identical to reality, but they can be said to agree with it or to accord with it in some way, is what I think he's saying. And then he talks about what that would mean. To agree in the widest sense with the reality can only mean to be guided either straight up to it or into its surroundings, or to be put into such working touch with it as to handle either it or something connected with it better than if we disagreed. And often agreement will only mean the negative fact that nothing contradictory from the quarter of that reality comes to interfere with the way in which our ideas guide us elsewhere. So often you have a view of a situation, a view of a relationship, and nothing is happening to contradict it. And if that's true, you know, you're probably going to maintain that model or that view, though you might have held another one. I guess what I would say is I have the experience very often of reality contradicting it. And it could be true in personal relationships for sure. You know, I have this model about why somebody's behaving the way they are, what's going on, what the relationship is, and something will happen and it's like, given how it was, what just happened is impossible given how I was thinking about it. So, you know, maybe if I'm feeling really good that day, I'll shift how I'm thinking and feeling about it a little bit. And it seems to happen a lot. To copy a reality is one very important way of agreeing with it, but it is far from being essential. The essential thing is the process of being guided. And so again, rather than saying the world is all screwed up and I won't play because it doesn't fit the model, it would be nice if we're a little bit malleable about how we model things, okay? Any idea that helps us to deal, whether practically or intellectually, with either the reality or its belongings, that doesn't entangle our progress in frustrations. And again, every time I read this, I think about the instances which don't work that way. I mean, I have all kinds of ways of looking at things that are continually tangling my progress in frustrations. You know? And some of the frustrations probably come from reality and can't step outside of them, right? But a lot of them are probably, you know, I'm seeing it in a certain way. And Donald Phelps said of a poet that we both knew, he's like a priest who got tangled up in his own robes. And that's sort of the way you can feel sometimes, you know, that you put on all these garments of opinions and views and you're just stumbling over them all the time. And sometimes it's not the other person or the situation, it's just the garments that you're tangled up in. Anyway, that adapts our life to the reality's whole setting will agree sufficiently to meet the requirement it will hold true of that reality. I'll just read one more. So this suggests in some way, and this is again not the moment of being caught in your own robes, but sort of getting along fairly well with a particular situation. And what James is going to stress here is that even if nothing is sort of entangling us, it doesn't mean that's the only possible model, but for many situations, a lot of models would work. I was talking in interview with, in work in the room with somebody within the last month or so, and sort of asking, well, you know, one of the things that we tend to do in our practice is if you find, and you say, X is really so Y, you know, person. X is just Y all the time. That we then say, oh, X is not Y, and we sort of try that on. Or if we say, I have this view about my own life, and when I hold on to it, here's how I feel. Well, what if just provisionally on the cushion you said, oh, let me hold the opposite view and see what happens there. So, such is the large, loose way in which the pragmatist interprets the word agreement. He treats it altogether practically. He lets it cover any piece of conduction from a present idea to a future terminus, provided only it runs prosperously. And then a little more to the point, maybe. We humanly make an addition to some sensory reality, and that reality tolerates the addition. All the additions agree with the reality, they fit it while they build it out. No one of them is false, so you could have various models for the same situation, none of which is drastically entangling you. Which may be treated as the more true depends altogether on the human use of it. So I really like that, and I think it has some relation to practice. You know, here's the way I'm thinking about things. I'm sitting on the cushion. All of a sudden, I notice that that's how I'm thinking about them. I'm a little bit outside that. What if I thought about them in another way? What if I tried that out? You know? And two things. So one is you may stumble upon another way of thinking about a particular situation which will actually work better for you, but also that very flexibility that, oh, that's just a way of seeing it, here's another way of seeing it, none of them is reality, which remains deeply mysterious to me on some level, that may begin to open things up in a deeper and more, you know, sort of long-term way. So I want to back up a little bit, or back out, and this will seem pretty abstract for a second, but I think there's something pretty nice about it. So this is, you know, if you sort of step back and take a big view of your relation to the world from something like this vantage, what kinds of things might be said? So this is the driest of the formulations. It's another book by James. He says, truth thus means, according to humanism, according to pragmatism, according to Zen maybe, the relation of less fixed parts of experience to other relatively more fixed parts. We are not required, and that's a little joke in a way, we are not required to seek it in a relation of experience as such to anything beyond itself. So the claim is you never actually completely get outside your own experience. It's always your experience, so you're always making connections among the relatively more stable and the relatively more variable parts. You know, he says again, are they not all matters of consistency, and emphatically not of consistency between an absolute reality and the mind's copies of it, but of actually felt consistency among judgments, objects, and habits of reacting in the mind's own experienceable world? And then one more passage here. It's the longest one. So what he's, the context for this is he's saying, in general, we have to test the model by bringing it up against something that isn't the model. So if I had a map of the U of A campus, I couldn't just keep looking at the map of the U of A campus and seeing whether it's a good map. I'd have to use it to get around and see how it works. Wittgenstein has a funny way of talking about a similar thing. He says, it's as if someone should buy many copies of the morning paper to convince himself that what it said was true. You know, it won't work. All right. So you generalize this, that I have to check my experience, my model, against something outside the model. You generalize this by saying that any opinion, however satisfactory, can count positively and absolutely as true only so far as it agrees with a standard beyond itself. And if you then forget that this standard perpetually grows up inside the web of the experiences, you may carelessly go on to say that what holds true of each experience holds also collectively of all experience, and that experience as such, in its totality, owes whatever truth it may be possessed of to its correspondence with absolute realities outside of its own being. And I think that's one of the lures of Zen practice. We think we're going to finally say, well, here's absolute reality, so I know that I'm seeing it correctly. And that, you know, the more you practice, the less that seems to be how it works. This evidently is the popular and traditional opinion. From the fact that finite experiences must draw support from one another, philosophers pass to the notion that experience overall must need an absolute support The denial of such a notion by humanism lies probably at the root of most of the dislike which it incurs. So again, you know, we're not going to find something wholly outside the realm of our own experience on the basis of which, you know, we might be able to evaluate it. Here's one where I'm going to jump tracks in just a second. For pluralistic pragmatism, truth grows up inside of all the finite experiences. They lean on each other, but the whole of them, if such a whole there be, leans on nothing. All homes are in finite experience as such as homeless, nothing outside of the flux secures the issue of it. I want to jump from there to a passage in a book that we read in the Tuesday evening group, Uchiyama. How to Cook Your Life from the Zen Kitchen to Enlightenment. This is a passage that we spent a lot of time talking about a few months ago. In the same way, we assume that there exists a world which you and I experience in common with all other human beings, that this world existed prior to our births and that it will continue to exist after our deaths. He's going to say that's not true, but he's not saying there's no reality out there. Right? But again, this is nothing more than an idea. Not only that, we wind up thinking that we live and die within this world of fabrication. This is an utterly inverted way of looking at one's life. My true self lives in reality, and the world I experience is one I alone can experience, and not one anyone else can experience along with me. To express this as precisely as possible, as I am born, I simultaneously give birth to the world I experience. I live out my life along with that world, and at my death, the world I experience also dies. I take that to be his way of saying something very similar to what James was saying when he says, you know, you can never weed out the human contribution, your own contribution. Does the river make the banks? Do the banks make the river? We're always in some way interacting with stuff outside us and with what's real. But in every instance, there's such an admixture of our own way of feeling about it, our own way of modeling it, and so on, that it really is a world that we bring into being. And I think one of the things that suggests, and it certainly doesn't mean you simply make your own reality, but one of the things it means is that the quality of the world that comes into being with your birth and goes out of existence with your death, and which you live in, is to a large extent a function of the models and views and opinions you hold. And if practice can make those a little bit more flexible, make you a little less stuck in ways of thinking and feeling that maybe are not productive, it seems to me that's a really good thing. And so again, I'm trying to suggest that some of the odd relation to our own processing that can happen in practice is, you know, we usually don't talk about ethics, but aside from anything else, I think it's ethically valuable. So I want to read one other passage from James and make just one slightly different point. So he says, this grows out right outside the thing about all finite experiences leaning on one another, but finite, your own experience can't be checked against something outside it. Humanism was willing to let finite experience be self-supporting. Somewhere being, your life, your being, must immediately breast non-entity, must come up against what isn't you, what isn't the human. Why may not the advancing front of experience, carrying its imminent satisfaction and dissatisfaction, cut against the black inane as the luminous orb of the moon cuts the cerulean abyss? Why should anywhere the world be absolutely fixed and finished? So what he's pointing to there, and it's like the thing we read last week, where there can be a moment where the models have fallen away sufficiently such that you feel you're just at the edge of your processing and your modeling. And there's a felt sense that you're brushing up against something that doesn't quite fit your models. And what I would suggest is that, at least in my experience, very often that happens in a very local way, and that in that weird way that Zen practice has, that can lead to stuff way out of proportion to the experience in terms of the extent to which you feel kind of open and exposed to the world. So it may be true that a particular model falls away and you get that experience, you get the sense in that moment that there's the world, it's not the world that that fits your model, and you're exposed to it and you're in it. And then of course there'll be the moment where you say, oh, I'm seeing things in my own terms again, but that moment when it almost feels as if, you know, you've dropped the models for a minute and reality sees you, you know, would be maybe the best way to talk about it, can be very, very powerful. There's a couple stories about the sort of relatively trivial occasions for this, and the, you know, the first, I'll just say the first instance is a really big one because it's not about me at all. So there's a story about Musō Soseki, who I guess was a 13th century Japanese monk that I've told pretty often, and he was working with a teacher, got frustrated, asked for the teacher's compassion. The teacher says, I can't give you a turning word, I can't give you compassion, because sort of doing tough love. And Musō Soseki gets up and walks away from his practice. And then years later, he's practicing on his own at a farmhouse that he lives at, and he goes and sits out in the fields in the dark and does his zazen, and then comes back and goes to bed, and he's got a lantern to carry him back. So sometimes he doesn't use the lantern, and this night he doesn't use the lantern because he knows the farm really well. And he gets tired, along the way, and reaches out and leans against the wall of a shed or something like that to take a little rest. Only it turns out the wall of the shed is not there, and he just falls over in this comic, you know, sort of boom. And in that moment, everything opens up. I didn't really know where I was. The shed wasn't where I thought it was disorienting enough that there's this feeling that, you know, the models are going to return in a minute, but there I am and I'm in reality. It doesn't mean you're going to get up and say, now's my chance, free of all the models, to make the perfect model. But it's like, oh, I'm in the world. You know, something falls open in that way. So two of my own really small experiences, and sort of trivial, and they don't lead to, you know, big enlightenment stories. But one of the times I remember, I think I've told both these stories too, but driving over to Santa Fe, which I used to do, I hope to do again all the time to go to retreat, I always go through Hatch and get the green chilies and this and that, but there's always a left turn that you make, and I was sort of tired, and I missed the left turn, and it's about, you know, 4 or 5 hours away from Tucson.
It's a hard turn.
It is a hard turn. Yeah. So, yeah. But it's like I know it, you know. So it's like, oh, the model works fine, you know. But I wasn't paying attention, and I had this really strange moment. I had, for a moment, it was like I had no idea where I was. You know, it's like I looked around, said, I've never seen this place before. All the trees look different. The houses look different. And for a moment, it was like, I mean, clearly, I just was about 30 seconds off my route. It's like I had no idea where I was, you know. It's like, oh. And it was very, very beautiful, you know. It's like, you know, just there I am. Where am I? I'm in the world, you know. And another one is somebody pretty close to me. This is a number of years ago, so it's no longer true of me at all, you know. But the person was saying that I'm really defensive. I am, you know. I said, no, I'm not defensive, you know. How can you say that? So I was sitting over at Zen Desert Sangha, and John Tarrant was doing like a weekend retreat, and he came around for a morning greeting where he passes everybody in. As he comes to you, you hold your hands like this, and he looks at everybody pretty seriously while walking along. And I had this moment where I thought, you know, I know he's thinking I'm doing it wrong. You know, he thinks I'm moving. And then what my friend had said to me, you know, occurred to me, and I thought, he may not have been thinking that at all, you know. And it didn't matter. It's like, so John was like, you know, being critical, or John wasn't being critical. But it was the strangest thing. It's like, oh, maybe the experience that I was inside of was just bore no relation to the reality at all. And I mean, that was like a small kind of Kensho experience. Just from that, I walked around for about the next 8 hours, and everything was luminous, everything was shining. I felt completely freed up, you know, really available to the world. So one of the lessons, and this is where I'll stop, is if you're having a sit or you're doing a retreat and you're right in the midst of, you know, all your opinions and they're really grabbing hold of you, not necessarily such a bad thing, because a little thing may happen to sort of bonk them off, and boom, things can really open up. So I'm interested both in that sort of disproportion of means and ends, and the ways in which all the sort of ordinary everyday things we do while we're sitting can open into something that in some way can really shift things for us. And then also in what I guess I would call the practical and ethical dimension of, you know, how things will probably go better for us if our relation to our own opinions and minds, you know, are a little freer. So thank you very much. I think we have just a couple minutes for any discussion. I'm sorry that I went on a little bit long, but it wasn't my fault. It was William James's fault.
What was the book that you referenced? Something you guys have read recently?
Yeah, Mary brought it in. It's How to Cook Your Life from the Zen Kitchen to Enlightenment, and it's by Uchiyama, Uchiyama. The beginning, there's a very famous, Mary knows more about this than I do, but there's a very famous manuscript by the 12th century, I guess, Japanese Soto master Dogen, called Instructions to the Cook. And this is, so that everything, all of practice is in, being the tenso and being the cook for the monastery. And then this is about 100-page sort of meditation on that by a contemporary Soto teacher, I guess. Is that fair, or is that right?
Relatively contemporary.
Okay, not so, okay, yeah. That's also the book in which we talked about this a few times, with the thing about there'll always be that disconsolate one, and what practice does is not to get rid of that, but helps you to take care of the disconsolate one. So that's the same book.
I think in a practical way, in an everyday life way, one of the things that I've really been paying attention to a lot lately is my own assumptions, yeah. Which another way of saying it, and trying to see other people's points of view, practicing that, which leads to compassion and a lot of other things, but it kind of goes with this because steps you back, and just in doing that, it's pretty amazing sometimes. Yeah. It loosens up. It's the same kind of loosening up of your held point of view or whatever habit or whatever way it is that you're doing things.
That's great.
And it helps.
I think maybe I'm particularly hidebound, but I will say, before I started practicing, that I really didn't do that very often. It's like, the way I see the world is the way I see the world, God damn it, And,
I have to say that's true.
Too. It's still true a lot of the time, but it's a little less true.
Yeah.
I think that's the most important thing to me about the whole idea that my world is created when I'm born and my world dies, and it is my reality, because that's how, from where, and that everyone has one, and they're all different. That's the part.
It's amazing to me how different they can all be.
And that you can be in the same relationship with other people, and everyone's is going to be different. And that's the part that, to me, it's fascinating, and it's also helps me to step down off of my high horse and, pay attention.
Yeah, I have a question then, because being an only child, child as well, is, you're at a certain disadvantage from the get-go, because you just have your own experience and from your parents, but you don't have, brothers and sisters to share it with, and or see in your life that there are other ways of doing, or points of view, so it's even harder,
one of my siblings and I, just quickly, when she started talking about her childhood when we were well into our adulthood,
and you didn't,
I had no idea what she was talking about. Mm. Her experience as a child was so different than mine.
Yeah.
With my parents, with the world, and I had no idea this went on for her. I mean, none. Yeah. It was shocking.
Yeah.
And so that was a good example of, from my
not necessarily
from my
so.
Two eyes and my experience, I didn't see it. Didn't know it. Didn't have, I don't know how I missed it. It was just like.
Yeah.
But anyway, so it's not always helpful, depending on the individual.
Though in hindsight, it might be interesting, all of you to get together.
There's been a lot of conversation about this.
Remember in the discussion group when we were talking about that passage from the Uchiyama, we spent a bunch of time on it, and one of the things that's weird to me about it is it looks like a kind of sort of solipsistic attitude, that would sort of lead you to not care too much. It's like, I'm only seeing the world that I'm seeing. I don't know the reality out there. And it could lead to this sort of callous response to it. But what we're talking about is it really feels exactly the opposite, So in a way, your life is Mary, is really affected a lot by all the everybody in this room and all the little bubble worlds we inhabit, where we have our own version of Mary, you know. And so if I think the way I'm seeing you is just the way you really are, and you know, therefore anything where we're not getting along must really be your fault, you know. Mm-hmm. If I'm thinking, well, the Mary I have is the Mary inside inside Tennyville, you know. Mm-hmm. If I realize that to a fairly large extent that's my own construction, but that how I interact with you based on that construction, you know, is going to have some effect on you.
The more reading I do about that word reality is such a dangerous word to use to use it flippantly, or because the more reading I do about it, the less I want to use it, because it's, everyone has a different meaning for that.
Yeah.
And every single one of ours, the kind we're talking about, as reality is different.
Yeah. So I'm responsible. So I'm responsible for taking care of the Tenny world, and there's a version of everything out there inside the Tenny world, right? So I get to be the steward of that and try and take care of it.
Well, you know, there's an interesting way of looking. I mean, it just occurred to me. So we all have Tennyville, Robertville, Maryville, Elizabethville, Bob and Mercerville. I mean, we're all living this. But, and then we assume the other people's ville is much like ours.
Yeah.
But there's also the idea that some people's ville, some people's space is vast and wonderful, mm-hmm. much more so than mine. And on some people's, you know, little ville is really constricted.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah.
But the interesting part is that there's no real delineation between your ville and my ville, because you're part of mine, mm-hmm. and I'm part of yours. But they just look different from, you know, and we experience it different. And that's the part that's.
Yeah. I know that sense of, like, you meet somebody and it's like, oh, their villa is really large and spacious, and there's room for a lot in it, you know, and then somebody else is like really like so I guess we're out of time.
I think personally I shift back and forth between the little tiny hard will and the wider.
That's great. And so practice is this invitation all the time to come at him to the big one. Yeah.
That's another thing that's interesting and not a known, is that we look at someone and we assume from their behavior, from their amount of interaction, from the amount of what they say, something that is not necessarily so. It's another example of that, how hard it is to really just don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. You know.
This thing, but if I can't be sure, I won't play. You know, but you gotta play anyway. It's kind of your innocence. Okay, thank you, everybody.
Thank you.